from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Look, in an election like this that was so hotly contested and so divided, gestures matter.
I am so saddened to hear that, and I say stop it if it helps. I will say this, and I'll say it right to the camera, stop it.
The battle for appointments to President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet being called a knife fight and buffoonery, according to sources within his transition team.
If the name Gwen Ifill ever came up, everyone would have some story. PBS anchor and longtime Washington journalist died yesterday at age 61 after a battle with cancer.
Yeah, it seems like 2016 has been a bad year for losing really important people in American society. I'm John Dankosky here. If you want to join us today in The Wheelhouse, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Ben Duvall is with us. He's a former Republican strategist, owner of Dramana Strategies, communication and public policy consulting firm. Good to see you once again, Ben.
Good to see you, John.
Susan Bigelow is here. She's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello there, Susan.
Good morning.
And playing the part of Colin McEnroe today, because Colin is still on the disabled list, is Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst. He'll be coming in just a moment. There's a lot to talk about today, obviously. In a little bit, we're going to talk about the future of the Democratic Party by maybe taking a look back a bit. But first, let's get into the news of the Trump transition team. Every single time we have a new presidency, we have this period where for just a couple months, we've got to very quickly transition from one administration to another. And that's more than just hiring a few key people. That's hiring thousands and thousands of key people who are going to occupy the halls of all those buildings down in Washington. It seems, Susan, as though the Trump transition team has hit a little bit of a speed bump here, and it's not moving as quickly as some people would think or like.
I love the description of it as a knife fight. that seems fairly accurate. I mean, suddenly Chris Christie is out. Chris Christie, of course, getting nothing for his steadfast standing by Donald Trump. Now he's off the transition team, and he's just consigned to political oblivion at this point. But there's a lot of people have been coming and going. National security people have been going. It seems like they were very surprised to learn just how many people that they were going to have to hire. It looks like a lot of this was really not done ahead of time. Presidential transitions start fairly early on in the process. They should start probably in the summer or even earlier. This one doesn't seem to have done much. They seem like they're really scrambling at this point. And it doesn't bode well for the future of the administration that they seem this disorganized.
Should we be surprised at all by the disorganization, Ben, given just the very different way in which the Trump campaign was run, the very different way in which he has promised to lead the country?
No, not at all. I mean, the campaign was run by, you know, one or two people, number one being Donald Trump, and then everybody else sort of following in his path. And that's what's going on here. I mean, they had no idea they were going to win this campaign. They're running to catch up, and it's going to be very interesting. I mean, last night was a great example. He ducked the press again to go out to dinner, and which some people think is great, but you know, there's always been a tradition of a press pool with the president or president-elect to follow him and or her, as it may have been, to track history. So the disorganization is unsettling. And I think his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has got an oversized ego and oversized power. I think that Mr. Kushner and a number of people, as they make decisions now, should read LBJ a little bit and remember it's better to have them inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in.
Well, you know, one of the things that's so surprising about what's going on with Kushner, Bill, is that you know, many people would look at Chris Christie's exile from the inner circle and his removal from the head of the transition team and say, well, you know, he's got this Bridgegate scandal. There's all sorts of reasons. No, that's not actually it. It's actually some sort of other dispute that's kicking him out.
You know, and I mean, all this stuff is just sort of, you know, these are rumors substantiated and otherwise abound in a moment like this. But it does appear that the son-in-law offed Christie, at least in large part, in retaliation for probably the only good thing Christie ever did, which was prosecute his corrupt father and landed up in jail. And so you see this a lot, especially with public officials after they go to prison. They don't feel contrition so much as a sense of grievance against the system. I would just say that, you know, here's one of the things we've seen in the campaign and in the transition already, and that is that people don't hang around Donald Trump for a long time. At the convention, there weren't a lot of lifelong friends. In the Hal Kohl campaign, there was barely a business person from New York who wanted to be with him. He had, in a lifetime of business, acquired no real lasting relations, which is what happens to a severely narcissistic personality in society so often. And so I just think this is going to be not just the – it wasn't just the campaign. It's not just the transition team. Watch the administration. This will have the largest, fastest churn of any administration in history.
Well, I want to speak to maybe the top of the ticket, as it were, in terms of this transition and also the administration. The picks this week that come out from the president-elect, one, Reince Priebus, a safe selection. He was, of course, head of the RNC right after his selection to be chief of staff. An awful lot of Republicans who've been distancing themselves from Donald Trump said, well, that's a good choice. We feel better that Reince is in there. His other choice as his top advisor is this guy, Steve Bannon, who we'll talk about quite a bit. Bill, I want to start with you because I remember talking to you on the phone in the days after President Obama was elected the first time in 2008. And you said to me, everything that you're going to know about how President Obama is going to run the country, you'll find out by who he picks as his chief of staff and as his top advisors. And you said, you know, watch out if Rahm Emanuel is the guy he picks. And Rahm Emanuel was the guy he picked.
And he never recovered from it.
Yeah, and so talk about that a little bit. I mean, that the person who is your closest advisor or your one or two closest advisors, Karl Rove played that role in the Bush administration even without that title. I mean, what does that tell you about what the administration is going to do if Steve Bannon's the guy sitting next to him?
Well, I'll say two things. First of all, again, everything flows from the candidate. Everything flows from the person himself. As Ben was pointing out, you know, that there's so much retribution in the air from all of these people. Well, who does that remind you of? Oh, right, Donald Trump. And secondly, that there are people like Bannon. What kind of politics has he practiced from the very beginning, not just of his campaign, but for 40 years now? Donald Trump isn't a guy who brilliantly strategized the moment. He's a guy who was always like this, and the moment finally came to him and then knew how to exploit it. And so I look at people like Bannon. This is a person who traffics in white nationalism. You and I also once had a conversation about the word fascist, and I know that it's an inflammatory word. I'd never called a person that before in my life. I don't plan on doing it again. But this willingness to use government to quash dissent and punish your opponents, inciting the violence, peddling conspiracy theories, this is happening. And last thing I want to say is I've never been a big fan or big believer when all the left was saying that the internet was going to really bring us a more democratic society. From the very beginning, I hated the idea. And, Sarah Palin proved you could have a virtual career hiding behind Twitter. You could lose everything and then just tweet, never take a question. In cyberspace, they can't hear your questions. And Donald Trump, the dinner story, all of it, this will also be an administration that will hold itself accountable to absolutely no one.
So this is – I like what Bill said about the internet. Let me just talk a little bit about that. So what we've seen in this campaign is the real division of American online life into liberal and conservative bubbles. And the conservative side of this is especially bad. The Wall Street Journal did this great thing where they could show you sort of liberal and conservative Facebook side by side. It's still up there. You can actually still see it. It's still quite current. The conservative side especially is just – there's just this vicious, vicious stuff from these very marginal news sources. And that's what Breitbart was. It's this sort of fringe news source that shoved its way into more mainstream consciousness. And what this has done is it radicalizes people. It makes them more extreme. It separates us from people that we may otherwise talk to. It also creates this self-reinforcing loop.
But I will say, though, I think a lot of people on the right, Susan, would say that the left's fake news sources and their very partisan news sources can be just as vicious in the way they attack people on the other side.
I'm sure they would say that. And that's, I think, what we're all kind of geared towards believing at this point, because there's people making tons of money off of outrage-inducing headlines. Just things you're supposed to click on. There's all these content farms out there. There's actually a bunch of Macedonian companies that are actually creating fake news But it's not just the fake news. It's the slanted news. And Breitbart was actually really good at this. They were good at taking things that had a grain of truth in them or just sort of just opinion stuff, placing these outrage-inducing headlines on top of them, putting them out there, and they get shared by millions of people.
So, yeah, we may not get refugees from all over the world during the Trump administration, but Macedonian news, perhaps, is something that we'll have a little bit more of. Ben, what do you say to all this?
Well, first of all, Macedonian news has a great sports cast. But anyway,
I knew Ben would find something. Mr. Silver Lining.
That's right. Absolutely. You know, I think it's all due respect. I mean, the left has these crazy sites. The right does. Breitbart's site is repugnant. I don't understand why Mr. Bannon is who he is when you look at his background. I mean, he's a naval officer. He went to Harvard. Well, there you go. You know, I mean, he's a really—
At Georgetown, just like Bill.
At Georgetown, just like Bill. Bill's probably some sort of Bannon,
but,
you know,
but Ben,
your plant.
But Ben, I've already apologized, okay?
But, you know, I don't know why he is who he is. He's a really strange person. The one person, though, I can assure you who have zero influence on the president is the chief of staff. Mr. Priebus is a nice guy. He's done a magnificent job juggling a lot of different interests for which he deserves tremendous credit. But that was a sop, right? That was an offer to try to tell people, no, we're going to be okay and everything. He'll have a desk and a phone and some staff. Mr. Bannon will be running this thing.
Yeah, I actually thought right away, Bill, that one of the things that you'll hear most often in the Oval Office is, hey, Reince, could you just close the door on the way out? We just got a couple things to talk about.
First of all, to think we would live to see a day when people would be reassured by the appointment of Reince Priebus to be the White House. Either way.
Right. See, this is the problem.
By the way, that's right. I'm never going to get it right.
See, this liberal elite, they just can't get it right.
Or spell or pronounce things well. I also want to just say, though, with all respect to everyone here, this really is the year of false equivalency. And yes, I'm sure there is some Breitbart-style leftist something somewhere. It's not in the Obama or Clinton White Houses or the one that would have been. This is a party that has been taken over now. The Tea Party in 6 years has perfected a monopoly of the federal government and is the dominant force in state governments and state legislatures, the single most powerful force.
But this isn't the Tea Party.
No, it is. No, it's not the organization, the Tea Party, but this is the perfect Tea Party candidate. You know, Tea Party economics, the things they put first that the previous right hadn't are the things that Trump put first.
What's really unfortunate,
he's their guy.
And I've written about this, is this all began, and I used to be a Republican. I left in 2004. I'm now a member of the Great Unwashed. You know, no political party will have me. But
the Democrats are open these days.
Yeah, well, that's true. That may
be
true.
If you're really looking for
you can't afford.
Yeah,
me.
You want a cheap but membership fee.
But you know, it really began all the way back with Lee Atwater, and also on the Democratic side with the demonization of Bork, and these disparate groups on either side, and also overlaying this is a cultural phenomenon I've talked about, which is there's a tremendous lack of shared experiences, and it's a whole nother radio show, but through our entire history, all the way back to Revolutionary War, World Wars, Depression, et cetera, we had shared experiences. We don't have them anymore. Over the last 30 years, there's nothing that's bound us together. You know, 9/11 did for a week and a half, but we don't have that. So people go into these silos. The internet enhances it. It's not going away. And the Republican Party was taken over by, you know, very far right people. I mean, to the point where, and I wrote this a couple of weeks ago, that, you know, most of the people, first of all, Ronald Reagan would never get nominated, and most of the people in the Reagan administration are considered to be leftists. And it's just ridiculous. And what I wish a lot of Republicans who have supported the hard right would look at is results. I don't have any problem with people have conservative thoughts or liberal thoughts. I'm all about results, and I haven't seen them. I mean, show me where the hard right's listing of things they want to do have been achieved. I haven't seen them. They get reelected.
But what has happened is they were able to elect a president, Susan, Donald Trump, and they were able to keep their majorities in both chambers of Congress. If you look right now at the New York Times today, they've got this really cool map, and the map shows basically Trump's America and Clinton's America, and it takes out all the places that Hillary Clinton won and leaves all the places on the map that Donald Trump won. And to Ben's point of shared experience, that map basically looks like America with some Swiss cheese holes in it, and those are the urban centers. That's every single city, for the most part, in America has a little hole in it. Now, Clinton's America is just a group of islands. It's just a group of islands that is, you know, everything from Minneapolis down to Austin, Texas, but everything else is gone. That lack of shared experience, the fact that we actually don't live next to each other or talk to each other on a regular basis is sort of, I think, why we are where we are and why the parties are where they are.
Of course. Absolutely right. And people are migrating around to get closer to people who share their values. And this I think, is just kind of human nature, but also just an outcome of the nasty political discourse that's happened over the past 30, 35 years. So – yeah, absolutely right. So we're moving away from each other. We do have these silos, and the silos encourage conspiracy theory kind of levels of thinking. Like what you said about results here, I don't think that a lot of people on the hard right, the people who really elected Donald Trump, I don't think they really care about results because if there aren't results, they can always be excused away by the conspiracy theory thinking.
I disagree with that.
No, I think absolutely right. They can be. If things don't happen, there'll be someone to blame for it. There'll always be someone to blame.
Well, look, and again, we'll just get quickly back to Steve Bannon, though. I mean, Bill Heeman, he's fairly famously said, I mean, his goal was to sort of tear it all down. He doesn't like the system we have, and part of what he was doing as Breitbart News, he has said as much, that he thinks the entire system has to collapse. This isn't about results of the type that Ben is talking about or results of the type that we would normally think of in a political discussion. This is results of a type that is much, much different that I don't know that any of us who watch normal politics can get our arms around.
I mean, let me just say, first of all, one of the problems here is that when politics is discussed at an entirely metaphorical level, then smash the system and drain the swamp, which two phrases that mean such different things to so many different people. Everybody wanted to smash the system and everybody wanted to drain the swamp. And now the question is of whom and of what? And we're going to find out how differently we see this. But I really want to push back on one idea, and that is just that, yes, I agree that that especially the right spent 30 years substituting hate speech for political discourse, and then finally the monster escaped the laboratory, and now no one knows what to do. And that's the Democratic line on this kind of. But the other piece is who created the conditions under which this kind of siren call would find this large an audience? And when I look back to the neglect of the Democratic Party, of its own base, and of average working people in America in favor of its donors, yes. Something you know I've been harping on for 10 years coming to the show, it kills me to see this. It kills me to see this. And now they have to walk a long road back to credibility as the champions of average working people.
I just want to quickly get to Tim, who's calling from Meriden. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi. As someone who is outraged at this election, and by the way, Hillary, is she up almost 2 million votes, popular votes, in the final outcome?
Yeah, we won again.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's very concerning. I don't really want to hear this talk about everybody. Let's all get along. If Trump succeeds, we succeed. I'm outraged by this guy, and the Bannon controversy, anti-Semitic remarks, really racist nationals for remarks and stuff. The test for me, for the Democratic Party and people on the Greens, left, everyone else, is what we do at inaugural day. Yeah, I want to protest this man. I want to say he is not my president. His appointments and everything else. If the Democratic Party doesn't, fight this man with everything that it has, it will continue to lose. If people like Sanders and Ellison and other people don't take control and get away from the corporate people, I mean, we're going to see, continued migration to Greens and other left parties along those lines.
Hey, Tim, Tim, I'm going to break in just because I'm up against the break and I want to get some comments on what you said, which I think is very interesting. And Susan, I want to start with you because this is part of what we're seeing right now. There are protests going on in the streets around America, and those protests share some of what Tim just said, a sentiment that this is not my president. But I think what they're also protesting is some things that we've seen, tangible things in the world, that there have been the FBI has said there's been an increase in hate speech, hate crimes. We've seen swastikas painted places that we've not seen before. We've seen people, whether they're immigrants or people of color, harassed in a way they haven't been harassed before. And many of the protesters who are in the streets are protesting Donald Trump, but they're also protesting what I think they see as a rise in the type of violence and very scary behavior that's concerning them.
No, and I completely agree. And this is not a time for reaching out and trying to heal these wounds. I completely agree with that. I think that this is a time, this is a national civic emergency. We cannot pretend that this is normal. We can never pretend that. What's not normal here is the blatant racism that was coming out of Trump's mouth, but also the hatred and racism displayed by his rallies, by his supporters, and the racist man who is now just steps from the Oval Office,
but
Steve Bannon.
But what do people – what I want to understand, though, is what are people doing? What does that look like? What does pushing back against that look like practically in America today?
The left is trying to figure this out, and this is where a lot of the conversations on the left have been lately. Right now, I'm seeing a lot of people donating to the ACLU. That's one thing. People are going to be out in the streets protesting it. People are calling their congressmen. I think a lot of people are also just trying to band together. The amount of grief and worry among people who are my friends, people that I know, everyone is scared to death of this. And we're all kind of getting together to try and see what we can save of it.
Well, I agree with much of what you said about people being scared and a lot of this racist talk, which should not be minimized. However, I tend to agree with the president. Don't boo, vote. And a lot of Democrats did not vote, and a lot of people who are strongly being affected by this language did not vote.
But the voting is over, though. What do we do now?
Fine. You need to sit down with some sharp number two pencils, a couple of legal pads, and a pot of coffee and figure out how you're going to get your people into office. And to what Bill Curry said, the Democratic Party for years and years, and I wrote a piece in 2004.
Which
said, you know, you don't need Bruce Springsteen on stage with you. You need Bruce Springsteen's bus driver on stage with you. I'm not a Democrat, never have been, as I said, no party wants me. But the fact of the matter is the Democratic Party for far too long has looked askance at the working class and thought they were stupid and thought that they didn't matter anymore. And to your point before about results, the reason they're not supporting Democrats is because they go to bad schools, they got bad water in Flint, they can't drink a glass of water in Flint. They've got airports that are third world. They're not seeing the results. And they don't really care if it's a Republican, a Democrat, or in this case, a potential, as Bill says, fascist. I don't know if he's that. But people, if you give people a reason, you know, to vote for them, specific, they will. But rhetoric won't get it done anymore.
Bill, a last thought before a break?
Ben, when I look at the protesters, I can't help but wondering, did you guys all vote? Because I used to have a poster home that said, if you don't vote, don't squawk. And I'm for protest, and I support it. I understand people's feelings. But I think Ben has this exactly right. And the question here is policy and not message. If Barack Obama had done a public option to lower the cost of health care for the self-employed and working people, if he'd raised the minimum wage to a living wage when he had the votes, and if he'd bailed out the 18 million homeowners who got socked, he would have been a folk hero, and we would have won this election by a lot.
Well,
it isn't just that we didn't talk to them. Right. It's that we didn't help them.
How about a couple of perp walks of the guys in Wall Street?
Absolutely. No, I just had to stop talking. But no question.
But I'll say, and what's interesting, though, in terms of conventional wisdom right after this, people talked about what was the impact of James Comey and his crazy letters just before the election and whether or not Hillary Clinton's emails were this and that. Actually, the news that came out the week before the election that was most damaging was a reminder that Obamacare, it's put together, wasn't working for anybody.
No question.
That the premiums are going up.
You couldn't find an elected Democrat to say from the beginning, this isn't enough. We've got to fix this. They just went into defense mode and killed themselves.
We're talking with Bill Curry and Ben Duvall and Susan Bigelow. Colin McEnroe is out today. We're talking in the wheelhouse about the week's news. We're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about what a Trump Supreme Court might look like. We're also going to talk about the future of the Democratic Party. Boy, that could take us for the rest of the week. You can call us at 860-275-7266. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're working through the week's news with Ben Duvall, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Bill Curry. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Colin McEnroe is on the disabled list this week. Hope you feel better soon, Colin. Donald Trump appeared on 60 Minutes this past week talking with Leslie Stahl. There were a lot of things that they talked about. One of the things they talked about was the Supreme Court and whether or not his Supreme Court would attempt to overturn Roe versus Wade.
Will you appoint, are you looking to appoint a justice who wants to overturn Roe v. Wade?
So look, here's what's going to happen. I'm pro-life. The judges will be pro-life. They'll be.
But what about overturning
this? Well, there are a couple of things. They'll be pro-life. They'll be in terms of the whole gun situation. We know the Second Amendment, and everybody's talking about the Second Amendment, and they're trying to dice it up and change it. They're going to be very pro-Second Amendment. But having to do with abortion, what it, if it ever were overturned, it would go back to the states. So
yeah,
it would go back to the states.
Some women
and the states
won't be able to get an abortion.
No, it'll go back to the states.
By state? No, some.
Yeah. Well, they'll perhaps have to go to they'll have to go to another state.
And that's okay.
Well, we'll see what happens. It's got a long way to go, just so you understand. That has a long, long way to go.
My favorite part of that is just so you understand, Leslie, because you clearly don't understand
yeah,
all that well.
Right.
But look, there's a lot in there, Susan. One of the things that left out of that short soundbite is she's also asking about whether or not his justices would want to overturn the gay marriage ruling
right,
that more recently happened, right? Roe versus Wade is has been set law for decades and decades. Gay marriage equality has been set law for a little bit over a year. His answer was really, well, we're going to pick justices who would want to overturn Roe versus Wade, and then it would go back to the states. But when asked about gay marriage, he's like, well, it's settled law. And I think a lot of legal scholars are looking at that going, aren't they both settled law?
Right, exactly. A very, very strange sort of thing that he's saying here. And I'm wondering, how many justices are you going to find who are anti-abortion, but also be like, oh, yeah, gay rights, totally fine? No, I have no idea. I honestly think that Donald Trump is kind of confused about this stuff. He is saying things that I think he thinks people want to hear. What is Donald Trump going to do? This is the big question. What is he actually going to do? Who will he actually appoint? Who knows? Maybe he'll just appoint his sister. Who can say? But this to hear this kind of stuff, oh, yeah, he's going to appoint anti-Roe versus Wade judges because that's apparently not settled somehow, even though that's been a decision that's been there for years and years and years. And, of course, to force women to go across state lines. And I'm thinking of women who might live in, say, Texas or Kansas may have to travel like 1,000 miles. Of course, that's putting a tremendous hardship on people. And it's a terribly unfair thing. But I don't think he understands this at all.
Well, and it's potential. It's a potential he doesn't understand it at all. There is also a potential, Ben Duvall, that he will pick justices that he and his advisors determine are the right conservative choices, and then they may very, very well be on the bench for the next 30 years.
Right. I also think, though, that his cavalier, it was, I always find humor and everything, but I mean, his cavalier attitude about a woman, you know, going to another state, that is grossly insensitive. And I mean, I really wonder what the conversation is between him and his daughters. He has two daughters about this sort of thing. It's really dangerous. Now, I'm not casting a comment on Roe v. Wade. I just think that when you have a cavalier attitude about something that's so critical to so many people, it's somewhat disconcerting.
It's almost as if he is disrespectful towards women.
Hmm. Bill, yeah, a quick
well,
thought?
Yeah. Well, that's I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. You know, I just would say, you know, I guess they go to another state for the abortion, then come back to their home state to be punished. It's an extraordinary amalgam of ideas. Going back to the here's the key about all this stuff, I think, in terms of administration policy. It really is true. If you go on Wikipedia to look up narcissistic character disorder, you find everything but Trump's picture. And if you look up any scholarly essay on fascism, he checks every single box. And the thing about those two types, the silver lining is that narcissists and fascists don't actually have any policy convictions whatsoever. The tumult of these next few years will include watching him seesaw back and forth between the only two forces that seem to have meaning to him. Three, I guess, public adulation, but polls on the one hand, what the public's thinking, and the pull of his right-wing base. And this is just going to be a kind of bouillabaisse of responses from moment to moment of either trying to go with the polls or enslaving himself to the base. And we who don't think like he does have to learn to play that game right now.
But this is part of the sort of emergency situation now. The problem with people trying to respond to this is that we don't know what he's going to do, but we have to take him at his word that what he said on the campaign trail, that stuff that he really wants to do. We can't assume otherwise. We can't assume that he's not going to do this stuff. So we have to assume immigration. We have to assume he's going to try to deport lots and lots and lots of people. We have to assume that he is going to build that wall, that he's going to put that Muslim registry up. We have to assume all this stuff. And this is why the emergency is now and why just running for office in 2 years is not necessarily going to cut it.
I
want to get to a couple of phone calls because a lot of people want to join us. Robert's in East Hampton. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Hey, I voted for Donald Trump. I'm a proud supporter of that. And I'd like to get just the opinions about, you know, your guests and yourself, actually, also on, are there any positive attributes for Donald Trump and his administration on moving things forward here? Possibly what good could come out of this rather than just the negative aspects of his campaign and his rhetoric.
I'd like to hear yours. Robert, start us with yours because that'll help me.
Excuse me?
Start us with some of yours. I mean, what's a positive attribute? What's something that you feel very strongly about, a reason why you supported Donald Trump?
Well, the whole thing is, again, the complete change of our government. On how, the last 8 years of liberal progressive movements of President Obama with his executive privileges of just ramming things down our throats if we don't agree with his opinion on same-sex marriage, abortion, gay rights, and this isn't hateful stuff. These are beliefs that people have. And I'm not saying it's hate. Hateful. There's honest beliefs in this country that people believe in. We showed it by the vote.
But Robert, I just want to push back a little bit because I really appreciate your phone call. Is give me something about Donald Trump, because I think that what I've heard you say and what I've heard an awful lot of people say, honestly, is what I think is wrong with America under Barack Obama, the things that I don't like. So give me something about Donald Trump specifically, his character, what you think he's going to do that you really support personally.
Yeah, well, give him a chance. I mean, that's the whole thing. A lot of it is rhetoric. What he produces, you're saying, well, we can't doubt that he won't do these things, and I can't say that. But, politicians lie all the time on the campaign trail. He more or less did, and they all do it to do what they need to be voted in. What he may do in office may astound everybody.
Well, Robert, I appreciate you, and we do want to get some thoughts from our panel here. We're going to go to Ben Duvall first, and then everyone wants to chime in. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'll help. It's Robert, correct?
Yes.
I understand his comments, and I can appreciate them. But what I would ask him to do is to hold Mr. Trump accountable. I totally understand Robert's frustration about politicians say whatever they can to get elected and all. But Mr. Trump has said that we're going to get rid of Obamacare and we're going to replace it with something that's, quote, better and cheaper. I'm all for that. He's going to build a wall with against Mexico, with Mexico paying for it. Make sure we hold them to that. I'm not big on walls, but I am big on an immigration policy we should have. We're not going to send our troops to foreign lands anymore to fight for other people. Let's hold them to that. So I think those are some of the things that, if I can be so bold, is to assume that Robert's voting for, because that's what Mr. Trump has said he's going to do. So I'm looking forward to that. Susan is right in that, 2 years from now about getting people elected, but it takes a long time to get someone elected. So all I would say is people who are protesting, I think it's great. I'm all for it. But you have to get down to the blocking and tackling of changing policy. And if you switch the House of Representatives by 40-some votes, you're going to block some of the things you don't want Mr. Trump doing.
I think that the only thing that I actually liked, even a little bit, that he said on the campaign trail was his comments about infrastructure. He's promised that he's going to spend a lot of money on infrastructure. Now, how he's going to do that, who knows? But if that were to happen, you know, that would be a positive thing. That's the only thing I can think of.
Bill?
First of all, I just want to do a quick correction. That is that President Obama used the executive order far less than many of his predecessors, including George W. Bush. This was just a talking point manufactured on the right, and you only believe it if you weren't paying attention to the previous administrations. The second thing I just want to say is that, there is – I agree with Susan that the infrastructure is the single consensual point that I find among the two political parties. Every member of Congress has been saying he or she is for it for a long time now. Trump campaigned on it. There will be an infrastructure program. I will add, however, this, that usually a Republican president comes in and the first thing they want to do is pass their tax package. And many people, especially Republican presidents, if the Republicans who've all the Republicans have agreed on a massive tax cut, if Trump goes in and cuts and does his tax package first and really does most of it, he will have crippled his government for the rest of his administration in a way that he himself couldn't begin to understand. And not only do all of our own present budgets fail to meet the standards of responsibility, none of them include the cost of climate change. None of them include the cost of infrastructure. And none of them include the cost of our ever going to war again. By the way, that's the last thing. The one big question about Trump is, what will this foreign and national security policy look like? He was both a belligerent and a pacifist, depending upon the context as he ran. If there is some possibility here that the United States will consider alternatives to unilateral military intervention in the first instance, it could be that something good comes out of it. So infrastructure, national security, I'm looking to see what happens.
Well, I don't know if a lot of the stuff that I heard from Trump about his international policies, especially his growing closer to Russia, that's concerning. His backing away from our alliances and commitments, I think that outweighs anything he said about not going to war, because what's going to happen is if he backs out of these things, undermines the liberal international order that's underpinned global safety and security for 70 years, it's going to cause chaos.
But I agree 100%. I was just trying to answer Robert's question is there a silver lining? And I tried to find one, but you're completely right.
One more quick phone call before we go. John's in Shelton. Hey, John.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's up?
I'm a contractor builder in the state of Connecticut, and I listen to all this stuff, and you see how the people are complaining and you know, basically saying, well, why did Trump win? All you have to do is look at last night's shows and see the three mayors of these major towns, major cities, talking about, you know, this immigration thing where they're going to block this stuff, the sanctuary cities. You see all these policies, and the previous person hit the nail on the head. It basically, people are fed up with people saying things and not doing these things. Then you have the mayors of these major cities not giving anyone a chance to even transition into the government. You know, they're attacking Trump because he's disorganized. Well, no one thought he was going to win. And what if Hillary won? Yeah, she's had a basic, you know, thing in place for years. So it would be easy for her. But to attack the person a week out and not give him a chance and start blocking all these things when we have all these problems. And the last person talking about our security interests abroad. What did Obama do? Except sit back and let the world descend into chaos.
So John, we're up against the
for Trump. Yeah. Are just tired of everything descending into chaos.
Well,
that's what we believe.
I'd love your comment on something though quickly for me, and I really appreciate your phone call. So I think a lot of the pushback that we're hearing about today, a lot of the pushback that is happening on the streets as people say, this is not my president, doesn't actually have to do with a changeover in Washington, which I think a lot of people wanted to see. It's not about whether or not we might get results from something new. It's about some of the other rhetoric that comes with this. I guess what I'm wondering, John, is are you concerned about some of the rhetoric that's either come out of Donald Trump's mouth or Steve Bannon's mouth having to do with painting an entire religion, the Islamic religion, as one that should be scary to Americans? Painting people who come from other parts of the world as fearful. That's actually something that a lot of people are really concerned about in America right now, and it is something that Donald Trump is putting together with all these other things. Is that something that bothers you at all?
Yes, it does. It absolutely bothers me, but I believe that he saw a chance as the Republican Party descending into chaos. I believe that he basically saw Hillary as just the status quo, and he decided this is my chance. I'm going to do something. Yes, he's not the perfect person. He's a builder. He's gone bankrupt. He's done all the things in business that he had to do, but he wasn't a public servant. She was a public servant, and she basically abused the system. And she basically denies everything, and we can fight that for the rest of time and see if we're right or wrong, but people are tired of it.
John,
and we're all concerned about what Trump might do if he's too bombastic, if he panders to Putin or doesn't, but at least someone's got to stand up and right all the chaos that has gone on for the last 8-10 years.
John, I really appreciate your phone call, and we got a break, and we'll maybe have a little comment about that afterward. We got to get a little bit more into what's going to happen to the Democratic Party, both here in Connecticut and nationally, when we come back with our guests Ben Duvall and Susan Bigelow and also Bill Curry. We're in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Colin McEnroe is out today, but Bill Curry is playing the role of Colin McEnroe. He's our Democratic political analyst.
What an opportunity for me.
former Republican strategist Ben Duvall is with us as well, as is Susan Bigelow. She's a contributor at ctnewsjunkie.com. There's a lot still to talk about, and I want to actually talk about Connecticut in all of this, Bill. Connecticut, like most of the rest of the country, saw this really interesting electoral map, right? We are solidly in the blue category for Hillary Clinton, but you start looking at the individual towns and you see an awful lot of red all over the map. That red all over the map showed up in movement in the state legislature. What should we take out of this election for Democrats in Connecticut?
Well, let me just say, I'd like to point out that on two previous Wheelhouse shows, I did say that the Republicans had a good chance of taking the state Senate and even have closed the margin in the House. And I say that not to flatter myself. No, actually, that is the reason I say
you're
it. I'm sorry. I was just getting on.
You're getting a plaque in the mail.
Yeah.
Shelton's going to send it to you.
But I do think that, again, I think that Dan Malloy is a perfect example of the Democratic Party as a whole in the country. This is a corporatist agenda. This has been an agenda that has not been responsive to the needs of average working people. And, by the way, when Hillary was running, you know, she said she wanted to bring Bill back to run the economy. And I thought she should have said she'd bring him back for reinventing government, because that was the best thing they really did. Pay attention to the action, get under the hood and see how things worked. And they did make it work better. We haven't done that. We haven't made our government more transparent or more ethical or more efficient in the last few years. Many wasted opportunities. And so what I think is happening in this state, and Democrats, again, in the leadership choices they make in the legislature and their behavior in the legislature, no one will speak up. When all those cities went into revolt over the education policies imposed on them, there wasn't even a debate in the General Assembly. There was insurrection in Bridgeport and a dozen other places, but you couldn't get a peep out of the Democrats in legislature. If they don't stand up now behind a better a blueprint, both for the economic and fiscal recovery of this state and for how a government serves the interest of working people, 2018 is going to be for them like 2016 was for Hillary, I think. And that means starting tomorrow. I mean, this has to happen right now, or it'll be gone.
So what's interesting to me is that Republicans have really done some good work in distancing themselves from the national party here. This is not just a story about how bad the Democrats are, but I think the Republicans are getting better at this. And they've actually presented themselves. Yeah, I know, really. Surprise.
Yeah.
But they seem like they're a lot better at doing this than they were in the past, and they are. They've tried to present themselves as a credible alternative, and so far it seems like it's working for them. What's going to be really interesting is over the next couple of years, the budget negotiations that are going to happen are going to be fascinating, because the Senate's now tied, 18-18. Nancy Wyman's the lieutenant governor, is the tiebreaker. We think, oh, well, that just means Democratic control. But that's not necessarily true on the budget, because you have Senator Joan Hartley, she's from Waterbury. Mm-hmm. And she tends to vote with the Republicans on budget matters. So suddenly the Senate can be a block to Democratic budget proposals. And that makes things very interesting. The next 2 years could be very interesting in terms of that.
I don't necessarily share Susan's comment on the Republican Party in Connecticut. I think the Republican Party in Connecticut has huge opportunities in front of them, but I think they've also tended to go the way of the National Party. You know, over the last 10 or so years, it's been a tilt towards, I guess, Tea Party folks. Their candidates for Congress are respectfully, because I give everybody a lot of credit for running, were very weak. Down in my area, Heather Summers won, and that's a big win for them. But I think that, in fact, the Connecticut Republican Party could do what Susan's talking about and cut themselves off from the national debate. I mean, there's plenty of money in this state, you know, for Republicans to get, and I think they could put forth a really progressive Republican-type agenda. I've never understood, for example, why there wasn't a more aggressive strategy by the Connecticut Republicans to go after women-owned businesses. But, you know, that's just me, you know.
Well, I just want to quickly actually play some tape from Governor Malloy, because, again, the Republicans who made some inroads in the state Senate and even in the House, they did so with a governor who's at a pretty historically unpopular 24% or something like that. Malloy has hinted at potential tax changes in the budget. He'll propose to the legislature during a press conference Tuesday. Malloy said he'll aim to make the state more competitive.
I think there are tax changes that I'd like to see that are beneficial to the business climate of the state. And so potentially are there offsets to something like that? But if you're asking, am I leading with the expectation that we're going to raise a lot of additional dollars, the answer is no.
Okay, maybe no new additional dollars, but at the same time, we're sort of drawing from the same playbook here. Malloy also announces a deal with AQR Capital last week. Under these terms, the firm would agree to add several hundred more jobs in the coming years in return for a bundle of loans and grants totaling some $35 million. Even with all of this, Susan, it seems like we're still playing from kind of the same playbook here, which I think I heard from a lot of Republicans and Democrats during this election cycle, they're not too terribly fond of.
No, and this deal with what is a hedge fund, essentially, is, you know, this is ridiculous that we're going to bond money to give to them so they'll create a couple of hundred jobs. Of course, this is the sort of thing that a lot of people wanted Malloy to do with GE to keep them around, so he's kind of in a bad position there. But still, we're throwing money at profitable, wealthy businesses to stay here and create a few jobs instead of trying to find other ways to use that money. Now, the problem with the state budget still, and this has not been addressed by him at all, is that 58% of it, 58%, and there's a good story on ctnewsjunkie.com this morning about this, 58% is all fixed costs, and that's pensions and salaries, things like that. Yes, we can fiddle with the tax rates, but if we're not going to get into those fixed costs, then we can't do anything.
Bill, a quick thought?
Danny Haar makes the best defense of the Malloy policies I've heard, but it leaves out the part about moral hazard, if you will, that you keep giving these grants out, then you have to give them to everybody. And that's one of my biggest pieces of opposition. But the main point here is you want to change the tax code in a way that helps real businesses that don't decamp at the first opportunity. Fix the property tax system, which falls on small businesses like an anvil every day of their lives. Small businesses get all the lip service and none of the actual service. It's the real road to growing our economy. And when Malloy ran for governor the first time, he ran on property tax reform and he ran on ending the corporate bribery development strategy. And it's not too late to do the right. It's never too late to do the right thing.
We just have 1 minute left, and usually we like to go to the outer sphere, something that we haven't talked about today. Ben, any last thoughts?
Not really. No, I think
you think we've said it all.
I think we've said it all. And,
Susan, how about you?
Make America great again, baby.
Oh God! And if anybody caught,
that's been used.
If anybody caught Kate McKinnon on Saturday Night Live singing Leonard Cohen's "Hallelujah," it was one of the most. I think. That made me cry. I thought it was remarkable. And every once in a while, every couple of years, Saturday Night Live can be culturally relevant. I wish that they would be more often, but that was amazing.
And I'll actually say, Bill, I will recommend to people your very nice piece that you wrote about Leonard Cohen for WNPR.org.
Thank you. Václav Havel, the great Václav Havel once said that there are many times in which the artists have to be the political leaders. And often in America in the last 10 years, it's felt like that to me. And the loss of Leonard Cohen was a great one. People who don't know the music, look it up and give it a listen.
I am disappointed we didn't discuss the New York Jets play calling. You know, let's get to something serious.
We're going to do that. We're doing that for a special Facebook podcast thing that John's got cooked up.
Make the Jets great again. Ben DeVall, thank you so much, Ben, for being here. Bill Curry and Susan Bigelow, our program produced by Katie Tolarski. Thanks to Kion Wolf. I'm John Dankosky, and thanks for joining us here in the Wheelhouse. Get better, Colin.